Page 24 does not have a primary. Runs straight into the supervisor.
Let's call tonight's meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission to order, please. Can we get a roll call?
Barnwell, absent. Smith, absent. Holstrom, present. Miller,
here.
Steele,
here.
Merkin,
here.
Cable,
here. Okay. Do we have any changes or additions to the agenda for this evening? Hearing none, the agenda will stand approved. And do we have any changes or additions to the minutes from the May 4th Planning Commission meeting?
Yes. On page 3, the motion, I think it's really high for Cable to vote both A and A.
They changed it. They sent out a revised one. Yeah. And there's a
Any other changes or additions? Except just for the record, we sent out a modified version of the minutes this afternoon.
Correct.
Yes. And that's the one we're approving.
Okay. So Linda brought that to our attention this afternoon and made the change and sent them back out.
I got that far in the adjustments.
Okay.
Yeah.
Since that came off before meantime, I think we can just have the minutes stand approved without any action on the change.
May I make a request regarding the minutes? Hey, would it be possible to have a clearer audio? Last month's audio was extremely difficult to listen to. A lot of static and so on.
Was it everybody speaking or just the members of the public at the podium? Or
everybody.
We can look into that.
Would you please?
Sure.
Okay. Now it's time for members of the public to offer comments concerning issues that are not scheduled to be heard on the agenda this evening. Any general comments from the public? Hearing none, we will move on to a discussion of Board of Supervisors and Planning Commission roles, led by Rick Sanders. Rick, welcome.
Thank you. I don't know if led by is the right is the right word, but I wanted to come have a conversation. First of all, I'm Rick Sanders. I'm acting now as chairman for the Board of Supervisors with the unfortunate passing of our friend Paul Tuke. So what spurs this conversation or the idea for me to come is when we had the question about the industrial expansion, the Ames industrial expansion, and the really large overlay of the industrial reserve, and clearly we lost a member of the Planning and Zoning Commission, I think, directly related to that. Paul Tude and I had a conversation. Paul was then chair. And I said, so is this a conversation we need to have? I mean, clearly there were some hard feelings, or appeared to be some hard feelings, over what you guys' recommendation was and how the board handled that. And at that time, Paul said, no, I think we're just going to let this thing go and ride out. And then with Paul's passing and me assuming the chairmanship, had a conversation with a couple members of the commission and Jerry, and just thought it might be nice to at least have the opportunity to have the conversation if any of you desire to have the conversation about at least from my perspective, what I see as our roles and how we are to work together. So I just wanted to come today at the start of the meeting and see if you guys want to have that conversation.
I think we do. I don't know how. I wonder if we can allow 10 minutes for that right now. Jerry, well, we said that is kind of our cutoff, but let's, rather than structure the conversation in a particular way, let's just take an opportunity to ask Rick questions.
And maybe it's a statement. rather than a question. At least for me personally, I don't know that it's necessarily that it was hard feelings. There was some confusion. And I think the history of it was we were the second Planning and Zoning Commission to look at this because the City of Angels in the commission looked at it, and they voted unanimously to deny it. It came to us, and I think we didn't see any overreaching or reason to approve it. And I guess that's why we did. And then it was sort of, you know, right after that, Ames City Council approved it with, I think, one opposing vote, and then our supervisors, all three of you, approved it. So we were, I don't know if it was hard feelings as much as confused.
Sure.
And what, it was like, what did we miss? What did they not think about? What, you know, why did what we thought not jive with what, you know, the governing bodies did?
Yeah.
So I was just honestly confused.
And
I felt like, was there something I didn't know about, you know, background I didn't know about that made those?
So, I mean, let's just talk that through, Linda, because I think that's completely reasonable. And I'll start with my perspective on both the Ames P&Z and then ultimately the Ames City Council action and you guys and ultimately the Board of Supervisors action. I think all four of those groups did exactly what they were supposed to do. And that's it. You can sure agree or disagree with the decisions, but a planning and zoning body is an advisory body that is set up to really work within the parameters as they exist at that moment in time. A city council and a board of supervisors gets to set policy, gets to amend policy, gets to work outside that. I would have, frankly, been a little concerned if you guys had not had any questions or concerns, or if you had just approved it outright, because that was a major, major change to the policy and practice in Story County and in Ames. And so I said at the time, Linda, and I stand by it now, I thought our Story County's Planning and Zoning Commission did exactly what you guys were supposed to do. I think you took exactly the action that you were supposed to take, or a really reasonable action, whether you were supposed to take it or not. And I think the Board of Supervisors fully considered that, and then we took the action we took. There is a lot of history to this. So, and if we've got time now, Aaron, I'll just briefly run through it. So, in 2011, the Ames Urban Fringe Plan finally got approved, which clearly is not a perfect document, but it's better than what we were operating in before, and frankly, it at least gives us some guidance. The second thing, and Leanne, help me if I get the date wrong here, but I think also in 2011, the Board of Supervisors voted to do away with the Lincoln Highway Corridor study, which was looking at all of Lincoln Highway throughout Story County, but our primary concern was the stretch between Nevada and Ames. And now this is before, this is right after Lincoln Way Energy had completed, it's before DuPont, it's before that DMZ line on 590th that Ames and Nevada had agreed to, but we clearly saw that, at least from the Board of Supervisors' perspective in 2011, that the highest and best use for the ground between Ames and Nevada along Lincoln Highway Corridor was probably industrial. So then you start to fast forward ahead, through 12, 13, 14, it becomes clear that that's the way things are moving along that entire corridor. We had not taken any action to amend or update the Urban Fringe Plan at that point. And frankly, it resided with Ames. Ames is the one who had to work through. Their big hang-up was the rural water issue. They had to work through all that. But once Ames decided that, yes, they were coming east along the Lincoln Highway corridor, it jives with what the Board of Supervisors had laid down back in 2011. Now, for me personally, the big hang-up was this idea of the, is it future urban, future industrial designation? What is it called?
The current, this is current business.
What we approved, yeah.
The East Industrial.
East Industrial, but my big hang-up was all the ground that they took into future industrial, right? And I really had some heartburn with that. I mean, that's a lot of ground that we're talking about going into future planned industrial or whatever the designation is, reserve, industrial reserve. But as I weighed that, and I can't speak for Wayne or Paul, but as I weighed that, I thought, you know, one of the really, really fair critiques, there's a lot of fair critiques of government, but one of the really, really fair critiques is government generally does a bad job notifying the public of what's coming until it's there. And it seems to me that identifying that over, you know, long after I'm gone, this ground is going to move toward industrial is a reasonable thing to say to current landowners, but more specifically, the future landowners out there. And that's the reason I came down where I came down. But Linda, so when we took our vote, I think I can speak for Wayne and Paul when I say this, because I know that as we finished that meeting, we didn't have any big concerns that we had just stepped on PNC's toes or anything like that. We thought we had just done what we were supposed to do. We took full consideration of the action that you guys had taken, and then we made the decision we made. And so I was caught a little off guard when we had the one resignation, and then I heard some rumblings that whether there were hard feelings, there was definitely confusion, Linda, on what was taking place. And so that's the reason that I wanted to come visit with you today. We view you guys' role as vital in the process that we go through, but it is a piece of that process, and it is not... Anybody who has the expectation that the Board of Supervisors is always going to come down where planning and zoning ends up on any given issue, I think that's a misnomer. I think a Board of Supervisors does well to heed the questions and concerns that a Planning and Zoning Commission has. But our scope is a little bigger and broader. You guys get to deal with the policies and precedents as they exist. Jerry, would you want to correct anything I've said, or have I...
You're spot on.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
It did in some ways, yeah. I still well, maybe I need to think about it a little bit in terms of now let me think about it.
Sure.
Okay. As you see our role, obviously to be consistent with the policies and the procedures laid out in our documents, regulations, and so on, sometimes there has not been total effective communication between the Planning and Development Board group and the applicants, which, and most of them, and they try to, but sometimes it doesn't happen. I see our role, Planning and Zoning Commission, and the Planning and Development Department, to assist the applicant absolutely in every way possible. So in other words, when an applicant comes to the Planning and Development Board, you know, it's their job, and I think that they do it most of the time, do the best to say, whoops, you don't have this. And based upon these regulations, here's what you need to do. So that those kinds of things can be dealt with and handled even prior to it coming to the P&Z Commission. Do you agree with that, Rick?
Yeah, I agree with that. I would add to it, Nancy. I would add to it that I believe it's your role to make sure that we're offering consistent interpretation of what our policies are, right? You guys do not have the charge of coming up with policy. You don't have the charge of amending policy. You don't have any of those. You have the charge of dealing with our policy as it exists and trying to make sure that all of our citizens, regardless of what they want to do, are playing by the same set of rules. And if it comes that there's got to be some kind of exception or we need to reconsider something, it either goes to the Board of Supervisors or to the Board of Adjustment if it's a conditional use kind of permit. But both of those come through you guys for a recommendation, but that recommendation doesn't bind either one of those groups. It simply is a recommendation.
Other questions or comments?
Aaron, you got a lot of experience in this. I mean, so what am I missing that we need to have out there for this relationship between the supervisor and planning and zoning?
I think it's mostly an issue of perception that this body invests a fair amount of volunteer time in this, and if they perceive that their effort is being ignored, that we're just an exercise that someone that an application has to go through in order to get somewhere it really matters. then, yeah, then the commission is going to feel, has the potential to feel a little bit dismissed.
Sure.
I would suggest that. I think this is a relatively rare occurrence, actually, for the board to opt in a different way than the Planning Commission and to do it with a 3-0 vote against the recommendation from us for denial that was also unanimous. So I would say that that's fairly rare. Mm-hmm. And it just,
I think it's happened exactly once in the 6 years that I've been on the board.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
A suggestion I might make is that if the board ever takes a look at the staff report from Gary and says, we just don't get this recommendation, I'm sure a representative of the Planning Commission would be happy to attend the Board Supervisors meeting to try to lend some interpretation to how we arrived at the decision we did. I mean, that's, Jared does a good job of that, I'm sure, but if you ever need, you know, one more voice on that, I'm sure that the Commission would appreciate being asked.
Absolutely, and you know, I do worry about the perception. I hope me being here tonight helps alleviate some of that perception that we don't consider what you guys think. I mean, I know that personally, I take into account every, I don't always agree with where you come down, and sometimes I see something a little differently than Planning and Zoning sees it, but we have that full conversation, and I would say this, Board of Supervisors will be willing to come visit with you guys anytime you'd like us to come and visit with you in your capacity. It's an absolute vital role that you guys fill. But it is one piece of that role as we go through administering the business of the county and looking at what development looks like.
I might also say we've already passed our 10 minutes here, but I would also add that it's okay to have additional scrutiny on the decisions that the Board of Supervisors make when there's such a such a difference between the decision that the recommendation that the Planning and Zoning Commission makes and the decision of the Board of Supervisors. Regardless of who's right or wrong, I think it's okay. That should draw attention to itself and lend itself to more scrutiny without anybody being critical of that scrutiny. It's just the way it is.
And I welcome the scrutiny. Like I said, from the first minute, I thought you guys did exactly what you were supposed to do with the information that you had in front of you, and the way our policy, I mean, it was a big, big change. Not for one minute did I go to Jerry, oh my, how did Planning and Zoning make this decision? And that was not the feeling we had. We just went a different direction. So, thank you.
Great. Ready to go?
Is it appropriate, and I understand the open meeting slots, that two out of the three of you can never go to a meeting to abide by the open meeting laws and so on. Is it appropriate for one of you supervisors to go to Jerry and have a conversation?
Sure.
Because I know that you folks get advanced documentation regarding what you're going to be looking at that particular meeting. So is it appropriate for one of you to go to Jerry and say, hey?
Not only is it appropriate, it happens pretty regularly.
Okay.
And if it doesn't happen with one of the Board of Supervisors, it happens with one. Jerry has regular conversations with Deb Shildroth in the Board of Supervisors' office. I mean, I think the board is fully up to speed with everything that's going on in planning and development on a day-to-day basis. I think that you guys' role probably is a little more disjointed with the planning and development staff than the Board of Supervisors' role, but I think that's intentional and necessary. I mean, I think you guys are supposed to be that fresh set of critical eyes that takes a look at staff and then makes a recommendation to the ultimate decision maker. I think that's exactly what it's supposed to be.
For the most part, they're looking at the development permit applications that we get, not the day-to-day activity that we see. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah,
really appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to move on to the public hearing items, beginning with case number subdivision 02-16, the Irons.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron. This item was remanded at the last Planning and Zoning Commission meeting, which was May 4, to request additional information from the applicants and from the staff Again, this is the Iron Subdivision. It's case 02-16. The applicant is Bob Gibson with Civil Design Advantage. Grimes. The property owner is Ames Golf and Country Club, 5752 George Washington Carver in Ames. The developer is Chris Gardner with Bella Homes. Before I go too much further, I want to introduce our new planner, Emily Zant. She comes to us from the Council of Governments in Minnesota. I forgot to introduce her before I started. We're very happy to have her. She's been here about a week and a half. So.
Welcome. Thank you.
Okay, back to the case. This item is in Franklin Township. The golf course is highlighted in red. It's about 154 acres, and it's on the northwest side of the city of Ames. The east limits is adjacent to the corporate limits. Actually, there's a railroad right-of-way on the east limits, which is the UP. Land use, for the most part, large agricultural parcels to the north, east, south. There are a few scattered residences in each direction, primarily to the north. There are some subdivisions starting about an eighth of a mile west along Cameron School Road. Those subdivisions are Jameson, Northwood Heights, Squaw Valley, South, and Bella Woods. The property is fronted by 190th on the north and George Washington Carver along the west. This is a closer view. It is across the street from the Christ Community Church. They do share an access point location with the Ames Golf and Country Club. There is a second access further to the north of this main one, which will be removed with this development proposal. That drive and access leads to the maintenance building, which their plan is to relocate that maintenance building to the northeast portion of the property. The golf house or the clubhouse is actually to the east end of the main drive that goes in, east of the parking area. And then to the south, there's a swimming pool and a tennis court area. A little bit of history. The Ames Golf and Country Club was a permitted use in the early 70s. A permit was issued September 6th of 1973 for the clubhouse and the maintenance buildings. So they were permitted uses at the time. There was a rezoning that took place October 31st of 2006, and it included a 55-acre area, which was along the western and the northern limits, which is shown here. It's about the west 600 feet of the property and the north 300 feet. That's zoned R2. The rest of it is zoned A1. Currently, the status with regard to the zoning is that the golf course is a legal but a non-conforming use. The land surrounding it is primarily agricultural to the west and north, and again, the residential subdivisions to the west is zoned R1. Proposed development, we've got quite a few things to show you, but they're proposing single-family lots along the southwest portion, south of the swimming pool and the tennis courts, and then two-family home lots to the north of that, and then three single-family lots to the north edge off of 190th. So we're into the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. This property is within the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. It's a land use planning document that was approved by Story County, City of Gilbert, City of Ames, back in 2006. The property is outlined in black, and the areas that would be for proposed development are designated rural transitional residential, which is in yellow, and the land use would permit anywhere from 1 to just under 4 units per acre, which this proposed development would meet. And the green area represents the area where the golf course is, and that's parks and recreation. So, you know, what does that mean as far as the three jurisdictions? This is from the plan. Basically states that the three jurisdictions acknowledge the primacy of cities' interest in regulating development in areas that the cities may at some future moment annex. So, in this case, this is in an area where the city of Ames can and potentially and is planning to annex this area at some point. It also states in part that cities are tasked with giving primary review and, if appropriate, approval of the proposed division of the land. And then, however, because of the agreement, the county does have the role of review and responding to the request, which is what we're doing tonight. So this is something that was provided by Civil Design Advantage. It shows you the proposed 14 single-family lots to the south portion. This would be on a cul-de-sac road, which would be a public road, publicly dedicated but maintained by the actual property owners of the lots. All the subdivisions in the county are maintained by the homeowners. And then to the north, there would be 16 bi-attached units and lots, which they would take access off that private access that the golf course uses. There would be a private drive extending to the north and a private drive that would extend to the south. Again, those drives would be owned and maintained by the landowners. Into the construction drawings, again, Civil Design Advantage, 14 single-family lots. Lot sizes range from about a quarter to three-quarters of an acre. The county's minimum lot size requirement is about 8,000 square feet, so it exceeds that requirement. Again, public road maintained by the property owners. They are proposing to install sidewalk, which would extend from a new proposed road, which would extend east of Cameron School Road, and eventually it would hook up with Stang, which would connect to the south. You can see on the drawing that a sidewalk is proposed for the east side of the cul-de-sac. It would extend north into to the bi-attached houses. This is the north end, again, 16 lots, approximately 7,400 square feet. County's minimum lot size is about 3,000 square feet, so it exceeds that by twice the amount. And again, sidewalks are proposed for this development. And they are also proposing to construct a sidewalk which would extend along the east side of George Washington Carver. And then the walkways would connect to the walkway, which would be on the east side of George Washington Carver. Grading, drawing, drainage, stormwater grading. They're proposing a pond on the northeast portion of the bi-attached. This is where they would use this dirt for the fill that would be needed for the road or for the drives and for the lot layout, but it'd also be used for the drainage for this area. And then you can see two proposed pond areas to the east of the proposed cul-de-sac lot for the single-family homes. Again, that dirt would be used for construction of the road and for the lot layouts, and the land in this area would drain to the east. They're proposing Advantix septic systems, which are advanced on-site wastewater treatment systems. The arrows show approximate location of those systems. And then the gray blocked areas represent areas that would be used for the septic system layout. This is a proposed future sanitary sewer. Again, if it's annexed, and the plan is for it to be annexed, sanitary sewer would be extended to both developments. The thicker red line represents the main, and then the smaller lines would represent extensions, which would extend toward those septic system areas. Same thing for the bi-attached homes, the east, west, actually north, south. The darker red line would represent the main, and then you have the service lines that would extend from the main to the individual lots. Site closures, there's some questions about removal of trees. The applicant did take some site photos. It's primarily where the north side of the access is, between the two accesses where the maintenance building is and the main access into the golf course. My understanding is they're going to try to save this large tree. There's that proposed walkway that's to be extended through here, but they're going to try to save that tree. You see some of the condition of some of these is not the best. The county does have a requirement for significant trees that are at least 4 inches in caliper, that they, if they be removed, that you have a 1-for-1 or up to 1-for-6 trees to replace it. But there are exceptions for dead or dying trees or in situations where the trees would obstruct views of drives and intersections, or if it's considered like a nuisance tree, then it would not have to be replaced. But this kind of shows you the west buffer. This is something that the city of Ames is requiring along the western portion of that single family portion of the development. The circles represent proposed trees, so there's about 9 to 12 trees along there. And then each of the lots, outside of those lots, there would be trees that would be planted. You see the same thing on the bi-attached lots. You've got the buffer area, which is something that the city of Ames is requiring, as well as the trees that are proposed. And then there's also 1.5 acres of open space that's a part of this request. And there's and then on the south end, they're proposing to add another 2.5 acres of open space, and we'll get to that. We're into the site photos. This is the main entrance that goes into the Ames Golf and Country Club from George Washington Carver. We're looking at the clubhouse. We're going to be panning to the south. You see the tennis courts back out toward the road. There's a stop condition. One of the things that we placed as a condition is that they install additional stop signs at the intersection with this main drive and the two proposed drives. You're looking at the maintenance building. Again, this is going to be removed as part of the project. And this is looking southward toward the land area where the single family lots will be on the cul-de-sac road. Looking across the street at the church. This is the area for the bi-attached homes. Again, we're on the north side of that second, our furthest north access. And since we were there, we had to take a picture of the golf course. Now we're out by the road and panning to the east. This is, again, where the single-family lots would be. Looking directly to the south, to the south again, this is George Washington Carver, Cameron School Road, back to the church. A little background, the property owner and the city did work out some agreements. Again, they've been working on this for at least 2 years. I've been told longer than 2 years. In May of 2014, the golf course requested the city council to grant certain waivers based on their plans to do a subdivision. In return of the city granting waivers, the city signed and submitted 3 required covenants. One dealt with a issue involving annexation, that they apply for annexation at the time the city requests it, that they waive objections to assessments that may be imposed in the future if public improvements are brought to the site as an assessment project, and 3, pay any fees associated with the buyout of rural water service territory. This is in the Xenia rural water area. Waivers granted by the city: a waiver to allow Xenia to provide water service for now rather than require a connection to city water supply. A waiver to allow private septic system, which that's what's proposed. A waiver of the requirement that lots take access from interior roads. Again, they are requesting 3 lots along 190th. A waiver of the requirement that residential lots have a buffer from existing streets. And again, they're indicating that this is adjacent to a golf course, has frontage to that, and they're counting that as their open space, or including that as their open space. And then the last is a waiver of the requirement that all lots have access to sidewalks or shared use paths. The exception would be they're requesting a waiver to have to put in the sidewalk for the 3 lots along 180th. conditions that were included with the waiver request during that time period is all public improvements will be treated as if this were in the city, requiring city review of improved plans, on-site installation inspections, inspection billing to the developer. I do need to add that because this is in the county staff, planning and development engineering staff will also be doing inspections and monitoring any improvements in this particular area. The developer must also apply for and obtain a stormwater and grading permit from the city and pay fees and inspection costs. The Ames City Planning and Zoning Commission did address this April 20th of this year. And these were the items that came up. It was approval with conditions. And some of these things, or most of these things, have been addressed. Update the plat to show a 5-foot sidewalk connecting the north end of the Irons Court with the south end of the Irons Way and out to George Washington Carver. Update the plat to show a sidewalk along one side of Irons Way with connections to George Washington Carver. Three, update the sanitary sewer system to show one method of septic sewer drainage, which was done. Update the plat to remove the three lots on 190th. Again, they are still requesting that before you and before City Council and before the Board of Supervisors. Five, all public improvements will be treated as if this were in the city, requiring city review of improvement plans, installation, on-site installation inspections, which we've already mentioned. Apply for the grading and drainage permit, again, subject to city fees and inspections. Seven, completion of the Xenia Water Territory buyout and territory transfer agreement prior to final plat approval, and then complete an agreement for phosphorus removal plan prior to final plat. With regard to the Story County Land Development Regulations, there is a provision in the general regulations that deal with alternative compliance. Basically states that with their submittal, that if they feel that there's maybe an alternative way that reaches the same objective, they can make that request. And there are five items that they're requesting, and we'll go through each one of those. The first thing is there's a requirement that in an R2 district that they connect to a common water and to a common sewer system. Two, that new lots are required to have frontage to a public or private road. Again, the south cul-de-sac will be a public road. The two to the north for the bi-attach will be private drives. Private drive and length of hammerhead, which we're referring to as a stub road or drive. There's an open space requirement of 15% of the development, and then there were some questions early on about the setbacks with regard to a couple of the bi-attached lots. So with regard to the first one, common sewer requirement, their response is that the Adventix systems are extremely clean, are produced clean effluent. It's a system that processes does all the work within the system before it actually discharges. Initially, they were proposing to discharge into a common sewer, which would, or a pipeline that would be extended around the perimeter. At the advice of the county's Environmental Health Department, they did make adjustments, and they are proposing septic lateral fields. And then the common system basically states that they provides no real benefit. The benefit is with laterals is that you're dispersing the effluent throughout a larger area instead of concentrating it in one particular area. And as far as like connecting to the sewer, disruption will be somewhat minimal because of the placement of where the Adventix septic systems will be located, which is a big concern for planning and development and for the Environmental Health Department. Two, the requirement of R2 lots to have frontage onto a public road. Basically, Their response is that these are postage stamp type lots. Our ordinance does not specifically address townhome lot layout for the most part. And these lots will all have access from George Washington Carver. This particular layout has been reviewed by the city engineering staff. It's been reviewed by the county engineering staff, and it's been supported. Three private drives, dead-end street lengths. Again, there's going to be access to townhomes by a common drive. All the maintenance will be shared through a homeowners association with regard to snow removal, repairs, things of that nature. With regard to the size of the drives, they're going to be actually larger than what the county standard size width is, which is 22 feet. They're proposing 24. The actual pavement thickness will be the same as the county standard, which is 7 inches. The private drive access does align, as we mentioned, with the church. This is a location that people in this area are familiar with. And then it'll eliminate the need for additional accesses. We won't have to have additional drive accesses along George Washington Carver. The layout does not compromise the emergency access. Again, this has been reviewed by the county and the city staff. The turnaround design is supported by the city. We mentioned the width. Open space requirement, again, 15% of the development is supposed to be open space. Initially, their comment was that it's adjacent to a golf course. Everybody who buys a lot here is going to have access to the golf course. They can use the pool, the tennis courts. The concern with that is not everybody is going to be a golfer. Not everybody golfs. And if you have a dog or if you want to walk with your kid, you can't just do that anytime you want to do that. So you'll see in a drawing here in a little bit that they're proposing a 2.5-acre area, which is where a pond will be, that they can use that for some open space for people who actually live in that development to enjoy. So here's the location. It's a triangular shape southeast of the cul-de-sac road. And again, that's the location of one of the ponds. The last thing is with the bi-tax lots. There were some issues early on with the setbacks. It will meet the setback from George Washington Carver, Lot 31. It will not meet the 25-foot setback from the lot line. Again, these are smaller lots without right-of-way. As far as the analysis with regard to the development, again, the rezoning is a part of the R2 zoning district, which was approved in the county. County did approve this for single family and two family homes during that time period. It is within the Ames River Fringe Plan, which brings the city of Ames and the county together to try to work out these issues. The project is consistent, however, with the plan with regard to the density of 1 to less than 4 units per acre. And as I mentioned, the applicant and the city have been working on agreements for the last 2 years with regard to the plan. Alternative compliance, for the most part, staff and environmental health planning staff, we think what's proposed is a much better alternative than what was submitted. The effluent discharge would be spread out throughout a broader location. Connecting to the sanitary sewer will be better than what was initially showed. Again, you see the Advantix septic systems And then the actual lateral fields, which are the gray areas. Two, with regard to the lots and the frontage, each property has their own access to the private drives. They'll have their own access to the public roads, which is probably the best thing. The lots in the bi-attached, so lots 15 through 18, will have frontage to George Washington Carver. See there. These are the lots that have the double frontage. And again, all the lots will have frontage to either the private drives or the public road. Three public roads are required for subdivisions over four lots, and hammerheads may be used for dead-end streets. Things with the hammerhead, it does allow a vehicle to change direction completely, and so you're facing out to the main road. However, with what is proposed, it provides for more space to deal with the septic layout issue, which is a good thing. They're going to need the green space for that. We already talked about the width that exceeds the county's width standards. It matches the pavement thickness. And then the access location, and it's an established location that people in that area are familiar with. We are suggesting that stop signs be installed at the intersection with the main drive.
Excuse me, where would stop signs be installed?
They would be right here. This is the George Washington Carver. This is the main drive going in. So there would be a stop sign on either side.
Okay, so coming out from the church, there would also be a stop sign?
Correct. There's there one now.
Yeah. How about Bennett? I'm sorry to keep all the questions, right in. Cameron School Road and the part that's now going to be called Stang. Would there be stop signs there? Would there be any traffic control? It would just be stop signs on the east-west road, but not on Carver?
I believe that there will need to be one. You're talking about the new proposed to the south.
Yeah. Just north of the
where it meets up with George Washington Carver, there would have to be a stop sign there. You talk about south of the cul-de-sac.
I'm talking about where Cameron would extend and become what's going to be staying.
Right.
There. So that would there would be a stop there for east traffic, east and west traffic, but Carver would continue not to have a stop north-south there.
Yeah, that's my understanding. There's one there now for eastbound.
Yeah.
And so for westbound, there would be. That's my understanding. And then the open space, we hit on that. They're proposing to put in the 2.5 acres of area. The issues with the bi-attached lots have been addressed, particularly with lot 31. 21, the lot is still, it'd be like 30 feet from the edge of that private drive, which again, those are the two lots that we were talking about. 31 is on the north side, and then 21 is to the south. We did route this multiple times to interdepartmental for interdepartmental review. For the most part, we took comments from mostly environmental health and engineering division. And again, the proposed layout for the septic is supported by the environmental health department. And again, the layout of the streets, the design is supported by the engineering department. Again, they favor having access come off of where the location is now, in lieu of having multiple access points along George Washington Carver for each of these lots. So as far as staff recommendation, we are recommending approval. In addition to the alternative compliance items that were addressed, we do have some conditions. The first condition is the preliminary subdivision plat shall show that 2.5 acre area that's to be dedicated and reserved open space. And provided for the exclusive use and benefit of the landowners. Two, the preliminary subdivision plat shall identify public utility easement areas. It shows utilities, but it doesn't really identify the actual easement. Three, the developer's engineer shall submit a planting plan, which they have, to address the location of the new significant trees. Property owner shall submit a copy of the agreement with Xenia Rural Water. That's four. Five, the property owner and developer shall submit a copy of the restrictive covenants, which they are proposing some. Six, the property owner and developer shall submit a statement of support from the Gilbert Fire Chief regarding the proposed water and distribution, which includes the hydrant design and layout, which they've submitted for their review. Developers shall install stop signs that we mentioned at the intersection of the main drives with the proposed two new drives. With that, you have four alternatives. Staff is recommending alternative two, which is approval with the conditions, with the alternative compliance items, and the request to put this item on the agenda for the Board of Supervisors action. With that, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Questions for staff?
Yes. Under your recommendations, number three is already done, correct? Which is the engineer planting, the planting option has already been submitted.
Correct.
The 4, 5, 6, 7 are pretty standard, and I'm sure that they it's either done and not submitted to you or in the process. I mean, those are pretty standard things. Now, this number one, you have communicated all of these to the applicants, correct? Okay. Have they, number one, have they given you any idea as to how they would meet that requirement? I mean, the exclusive use or benefit of the dwelling owners is the primary issue there. Have they indicated how they would accomplish that?
Not specifically. I mean, that's something that's addressed in the county's development regulations. It could be identified by notes on the plat and or included with the restrictive covenants. But that's something that staff is going to continue to work with them on.
Okay. All of these lots are next to the golf course, opening up to the golf course. Am I correct?
Correct.
Right.
To the west.
I've got some questions for the applicants when that comes around. So, is it a possibility that with that number one, there could be an exception? In other words, that it's not exclusive use or benefit of the dwelling owners? And my thought pattern is anybody that's going to buy one of these is probably going to have an interesting golf of one level or another. Right? And certainly with the social membership, even if they aren't an avid golfer, they can utilize that luxury. So the exclusive use of benefit of the dwelling owners, is it possible that an exception could be made or not?
Sure. Are you suggesting an amendment to number one?
I am suggesting that it be eliminated, number one be eliminated, based on the wording there.
Again, this is something that's in the county's development regulations that there's a requirement with a subdivision plat that they provide common open space to the tune of 15% of the development. And
how many of these developments have been next to a golf course? I don't remember that.
Well, since I've been here, this is the first one that I've dealt with since August of 2015.
Is Rand still here? Can you be a pseudo member of the department for a minute?
I don't think we ought to do that. I think Rand, if she puts off her comments as a member of the public, she's welcome to.
The point, though, is that not everybody that is going to buy a lot there is, you know, maybe, I don't know what the percent would be, maybe 70% of the people are interested in, you know, not everybody's going to be interested in golfing. I've read some things where people are interested in lots adjacent to golf courses because they're interested in the open space, they're interested in seeing the treed areas, the green space, and they know generally that it's going to stay in that condition, that the use probably will not change. So those are things that are of interest to people too who are buying, you know, land adjacent to a golf course.
The other thing was that, as I read the Ames conditions in the April meeting, they're still saying that regarding the three lots on 190th.
They're still requesting them.
The applicant is.
The applicant is correct.
But the Ames is still not agreeing to that.
Their P&Z recommended against those.
Okay, so we have a stalemate in that regard for the applicant?
We have a recommendation from the Ames Planning and Zoning Commission that they not be approved.
And if I could continue on that, Ames has said they eventually want to annex this land. So my question, I guess, in my mind is why would we not, if they're saying we're going to annex this land eventually, and the Ames Planning and Zoning Commission is saying we're not for those three lots, why wouldn't we be consistent with that? And we had some concerns when we talked the last time also about them.
And that's something certainly that the Planning and Zoning Commission can weigh in on.
Fair to remember that their Planning Commission is only a recommended body, just ours too.
Yeah.
But if we're consistent in our recommendations, then they give us a little more.
Yeah, because the matter, after here, it will go to the Ames City Council, and then after that, it will come to the County Board of Supervisors.
What's the bottom line on the open space that they are committing that is solely dedicated for use by this subdivision? What's your calculation on the percentage? What have they accommodated with that? You see what I'm saying?
It's a 55-acre area
that they're
proposing to develop, and about an acre and a half is for the bi-attached that they've got open space for, and then with this, it's about 2.5 acres of the total development.
And so that's what percentage?
I didn't do the math. We're really dealing with the whole golf course, which is 154 acres.
So what's one thing the applicant says in their materials is, yeah, I know that the plat is a lot of this land, but the actual area committed to development lots is relatively small.
Right.
Did you have to run the numbers on what you just lopped out the area committed to lots and what percentage of that is actually proposed to be dedicated for?
Yeah, I did not. Of the 55?
But less than 15%.
Right. Of the entire 154. Yes. I should probably add too that initially that was going to be part of a lot, that area that they were showing for that open space, that was going to be part of a lot, and it wouldn't have met our width to lot ratio in our land development regulations.
Okay.
So that's where that adjustment came, reducing the width, and so now we've got land that can be used maybe for the enjoyment of everybody that buys a lot there.
Any other questions for staff? All right, if the applicant would like to step up to the podium and offer any additional information, that'd be great. If you could tell us your name and your address, we'd appreciate it.
Good evening, I'm Bob Gibson with Civil Design Advantage. With me is Chris Gardner of Bella Homes, and we've got Corey Strait with the Ames Golf and Country Club with us tonight as well. I think I'll start with this open space issue. By the way, are you hearing me okay? I know that was an issue last time, so good. What we have proposed for the townhome area itself, there is an excess of 15% open space just because of the way it works out of each of the postage stamp lots have their unit on it, and then you've got the common lot that has the drive in it. But taking out that area of the drive, there's still more than 15% of open space for the townhomes. For the single family, Mr. Steele, it was like you were saying, we did calculate just pulling out those lots, you know, because if you were to apply that requirement per the strict letter of the law, it would say you need to provide 15% of the entire development, because we're platting the whole thing.
Sure.
You know, so that would have been about 20 acres or something. So what we did is we calculated the total area of single-family lots, and that's in my right up there, and that works out to about 1.8 acres. And our initial approach is very much like Ms. Miller was saying, is that with a golf course, they're all at open space, and each homeowner with the purchase of a lot gets a social membership to the club.
That's tied to that lot, too, not just the people. So it's a lifetime tied to that lot, too.
Yeah.
So not just the transfer.
Yeah, so they have access to the pool and to the clubhouse, right?
Tennis courts.
And the tennis courts. You know, golf membership is another level up. But still, that's available to them. Technically, it doesn't quite meet the requirement because it's not exclusively for those 17 lots, you know, because other members. But nevertheless, we are able to provide that area down in the corner there around that pond. And that winds up, including the pond area, that winds up being about 2.3 acres where we were really only required to have 1.8. So as alternative compliance, I think the only issue with that is that it not applied to the entire 154 acres and it just applied to the single family. So I think we've pretty much solved that.
Space is coming from that triangular shape. Yeah. And the pond.
Yeah, and the pond. Yeah. So, you know, it's...
Not from the street area.
No. Okay. Let's get up here. So when we were here last time, I think that obviously the alternative compliance issues are what we have to discuss. A lot of them are already either satisfied. I'm going to start with those first. Like number two, the requirement the R2 lots have frontage on a public street. Jerry has addressed that. And it's the whole concept of these postage stamp lots having access to this common lot in which sits their drive. And the setbacks of those lots, Jerry has also addressed here, and that would be item number five under the alternative compliance. And the reality is that the setback is from George W. Carver, and we have more than the required 30 foot. We've got, setback is 40 feet, and we've got more than that for those two lots. So I think we're good there. 15% open space we talked about. So really the two things were the septic system and then length of the private drives and how that the private drives worked in with your private street ordinance and so on. But I'm going to start with the septic system. This is the Advantage system. And I don't know, did you guys get this in your packets? Okay. So the advantage of this system is it takes up the actual treatment area is a pretty small footprint, and it filters and processes the effluent, and it actually discharges water so clean that it can be used for drip or subsurface irrigation or discharged to shallow, inconspicuous trenches. And when we were looking at this early on, and actually even many years ago when I was working on the Rose Prairie tool, we were looking at some options to this. We had talked with the county and the possibility that you could just discharge this into the road ditches. It's that clean. It removes so much, all the suspended solids, it comes out clear. It even removes some of the nitrogen as well. Not all of it, of course. But one of the other advantages to it is that because it's so clean, that the lateral fields, if that's how you're going to discharge it, they're going to be smaller than normal because that water is so clean and you don't have to disperse the other stuff. So that's the first thing we're asking for, alternative compliance to the common system, is that we are saying that this works just as well as if we gathered them all into one system. So obviously we can't use a municipal system because it's just not there. But gathering this and like creating one little station for all the lots would take up valuable ground, but it would also concentrate the discharge area by necessity, and whereas by breaking it up like we have, we're spreading it out, the discharge allowing greater area for filtration from each of the individual units through the soil. So, well, before I move on, any questions on that septic?
I have a question. Sure. Are you going to be able to exit the homes under the basement slab for the sanitary sewer? Or are the restrictions for the lateral depth going to prohibit that?
We're going to exit.
Yeah, so yeah, plumber. Yep. Fourth generation plumber, actually. We'll probably have to have a lift station on some of them in the basement plumbing, so the main line of the house will gravity feed out and lift the basement up to that gravity. So you're going to exit out the side of the house. We propose that for a variety, a couple of reasons, mainly identified so that we can still use the primary tank, solid exit into that solid tank, and then into the Vantex system from there out to the rear of the house. And then in the future, if annex ever gets annexed, we can also just take off that side lard and go straight down the property line into the new system without having to tear up any front yard, without having... Otherwise, if we exit to the back of the house, then we're trying to go around swing to the front, or if we exit to the front, then we're trying to swing all the way around to the Vantex system. So off the side, it worked really well to be able to accomplish both without any, with minimum future damage to the yards, retain walls, etc., landscaping. So that was our plan.
So with this particular septic system, you still probably are required, you know, deeper than about 24 inches with your laterals in.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. It gets pumped out of the treatment chamber into the laterals. So. Any other questions on septic? Let me go over the length of the private drives. There was discussion last time whether these are private drives or private streets. We still contend that they're private drives because they're accessed off the private drive into the golf course. And there will be an easement, a cross easement for the townhome owners and for the golf course, so you know all legal issues are taken care of. But those drives running north and south, there was, I think your typical private street ordinance is a limit of 300 feet, and I think I have it here somewhere. Yeah, 300 feet in length for a dead-end street with a hammerhead serving a maximum of 6 lots. Although...
You dropped up a little more.
I'm sorry, I'm doing it again. Yeah, your ordinance says for private streets, it can be a maximum of 300 feet unless it has a cul-de-sac bulb, at which case it can be 1,320 feet in length, serving 20 lots. Again, these are our private drives, and again, I think this whole townhome arrangement is just something that your ordinance doesn't have language for, because it's not typical in a county setting, very common within a city setting. But as far as the design of those streets, they do exceed your 300 to the very end, but we've designed it where it has that turnaround stub, and we design that per this drawing. And do you have that on the screen, Jerry? That's what I sent this afternoon.
I don't know if I do. You're talking about the marketing piece?
No, the fire apparatus.
I don't have that.
Okay. I can just send it around.
I've circled the design that we use is down in the floor.
But that is the International Fire Code, and you can see that it... Yeah, the 2015 International Fire Code. That was given to us by Ames Fire Safety Reviewer. And so we designed it to that, and their they're happy with it. And you can see that. I think their maximum length is, what, 750 feet? And we're not near that. So safety-wise, the International Fire Code lets allow something greater than we're proposing. There's room, adequate room for vehicles to turn around and back up and swing into those turnouts. And in addition, which I stated in the write-up too as well, that especially those townhomes are so close to GW Carver that an emergency vehicle could, if they needed to, pull off to the side of GW Carver and have access to those units just as easily.
The shoulder of the road?
Yeah.
I mean, that happens a lot, but they wouldn't have to. You know, but they could. These lots are so close, you know, that...
Just saying, as an option, if needed.
As an option, but, yeah. But according to the International Fire Code, we are more than adequate with what was designed internally. So...
And that, I'm sure that would be their best option. I guess I was just kind of pointing out a belt and suspenders approach to that. So, questions?
I think that's it for the moment.
Okay, I want to address one more thing, and that's those lots, those three lots along 190th. City staff, they have specific requirements within their conservation subdivision ordinance, and that requires the sidewalk, and it also requires access off of an internal road. And obviously, with those three lots, they're going to access off of 190th. Although, Jerry, do you have that one in there?
Say that again.
The graphic of the houses with the driveways?
I do not.
Oh. Okay. Do you have it?
Got this one.
No, not that one. Any, what that graphic shows, if Chris has it, I'll send that one around too. It shows how those lots could work if ultimately this land were to develop, the golf course were to go away, which isn't going to happen, but if that were to happen, how those lots could still work with bringing streets down and how their driveways could be easily oriented to the streets. Yeah, this one. So.
Point is, if we have a by the City of Ames code, we could have a street coming off there, but we're asking for a driveway, which is arguably less traffic, less wear and tear, less need, less problems than the whole street. And a code, they say we have a cul-de-sac with 20 lots coming out of there, but we're asking for one house with a driveway. So it's a little bit of a play in words or semantics, whatever you want to call it, but it's ultimately essentially doing the same thing. That's why this graphic is designed to show that it's a road or a driveway. It's still one access point onto a road.
So from the city standpoint, it is technicality, and cities reviewing their standards and looking at it and say this does not technically meet our requirements within a conservation subdivision. And city doesn't have the alternative compliance clause that you guys have. And so that's where that's coming from. And as far as being consistent with the city PNC, that's, I guess you as a recommendation board would be recommending according to your standards. And according to your standards, those lots are entirely allowable as they are. And if you approve them, that doesn't diminish anything in the eyes of the city for what their planning and zoning has said. That's a battle that we have to fight with the city, because ultimately they're the ones who get the final say. So I'm saying that you don't have to say, just because of the planning and zoning of Ames has said we don't want those, you don't have to say that because they did. I mean, ultimately, they're going to get their way, or they're going to work it out with us one way or the other.
Yeah, we confirmed with Jerry and Darren Moon that these three lots, the driveways, meet every intent of the county code and every intent of the of legally binding lots.
Yeah, Jerry has requested that the two on the east be like a shared access point.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
One access for the two.
This graphic would show really what we want to do, the single access for those two lots and then the one. So.
And so that's how they can go in now. And if in 50 years the golf course goes away and they put those streets in like that first graphic I sent you, they would just redirect their driveways to the side streets.
I want to push back on some of your comments about the streets here, in particular the idea that we can just call those private drives rather than a private street and somehow have it make a difference. There's no definition of a private drive other than either there's driveway or there's private street in our regulations. And on page 707 of our code, it says private streets are permitted provided they serve four or fewer lots only in subdivisions and not more than four lots. And on page 709 of our regulations, it says no new lot, parcel, or tract created through a planning process shall be approved by the Board of Supervisors that proposes to take access through an easement, which you're proposing. Only lots shall abut a current or proposed public or private road. So we can call it a private road, but then the previous provision about limiting the number of lots that are accessed from a private road applies. And on the same page, in no case shall an easement provide access to more than four single-family dwellings or two or more two-family or multiple dwellings. So I understand alternative compliance is an option here, but it seems like we're not here as Rick pointed out earlier to make policy. We have a policy that we're supposed to implement.
Agreed.
And so we're walking a very fine line here between proposing some innovative solution that is better, as good or better than what's already in the code, mm-hmm. that will result in better development, and creating new policy by just saying none of those standards matter.
Well,
here's what matters.
But we aren't exactly asking you to create policy. We understand that. We're asking you to consider alternative compliance and saying that by doing this allows for actually a pretty nice cluster of golf-oriented townhomes. And your ordinance is not geared to this kind of development, like I mentioned earlier. It's something like this that happens all the time within city limits because they're more geared to that. And that's how Ames is looking at it as well, too. And that's why they have absolutely no issue with this. So it's getting past your language, and that's what we're asking you. Understand, that's how you have to look at it, you know, and point out that this does not meet the written word of our ordinance. And we understand that entirely, but we're asking alternative compliance. This is, we think, a good development given the configuration of the land and what providing some good opportunity for a market out there that people want to live out there. And he's got a lot of interest in it already. There's no safety issue. There are no traffic issues. That's why we're asking alternative compliance.
Can you refer only to the lots on 190?
No, I'm referring to all of
the townhomes.
I mean, it's a pretty simple statement that says can't access the new subdivision off of an easement. And that's exactly what
we're We could change that and grant the golf course the easement over the townhome property.
Well, another concern I have is this kind of stacking of alternative compliance, where one request for alternative compliance depends on a previous one and depends on a previous one. So, for example, in allowing the Adventix or in asking for it, in wanting us to reduce our open space requirement, one of the things we refer to is the size of the townhomes and how they're larger than most townhomes lots are. But those are proposed to be larger so they can accommodate the Advantech systems, which also require alternative compliance. And the private streets,
mess with the setback requirements. So we can not adhere to certain setback requirements because we're calling that a driveway instead of an actual public street, which requires a setback. So that's a concern of mine too, where we're just, I don't feel like we're granting alternative compliance. I feel like we're being asked to grant waiver and waiver and waiver at one after another.
Yeah, Mr. Joe, I sincerely hear what you're doing, and you're exactly right of what your code says. I mean, I'm not going to, no one can argue that. That's very clear what's written there. My opinion, I feel like this chunk of ground is a unique piece of the layers that it's in, and the Urban Fringe Plan of Ames, the Ada Hayden Conservation District, and then the Northern Growth Map. There's three layers there that make this a unique, complicated piece. Very challenging, honestly. I mean, I hope you can see the challenge that I'm faced with, and Bob here and Corey, that we're trying to make everyone happy here. So we're trying to make the City of Ames staff happy, trying to make you guys happy. And this has been foreseen. I mean, thank goodness that people back in 04, 05, 06, 07 of County and Ames had the foresight to see that this is going to be a challenging spot at some point when this is going to be developed. And so there was agreements put in place to handle and maps drawn to show where this piece of ground was handled and how that's handled, where Bella Woods was, how that was handled. Because at one point, there is no way to agree and satisfy every governing body in here in this particular case. If I do exactly what the county says, then that doesn't meet what Ames says. If I do what Ames says, it's not to the letter of law what the county says. So who decides, or how does that get decided? And that's why this agreement that was done and
done, Ames Urban Fringe.
Or Ames, yeah. Urban Fringe was that '06 one, or I can't remember which year it was, but that's what that agreement was put in place. County, Ames, everybody voted on it and agreed to it and signed, and now binding resolution to help this very exact situation that we're going through right here. So.
Will there be fire hydrants?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
How many?
I don't know offhand, but basically per CDOS.
The radius is mad.
In our construction drawings, we show the hydrant radius. I don't think we have it in the preliminary plat. Jerry, do we?
But yes, in all per CDOS, per code.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm thinking of a fire apparatus and engine and tank in there would be a nightmare.
Well, not according to the International Fire Code.
And the City of Ames Fire.
Okay. Access road width, again, what was the width you said it was going
to
be?
24 feet back to back.
When a fire hydrant is located on a fire apparatus access road, the minimum road width shall be 26 feet.
That's on that graphic?
Yes, it is. D103.1.
Okay. Well,
minimum specifications.
Okay. We can change that.
Yeah.
That's not a problem.
But you would need to if you're saying you should follow these.
Yep. Yep. And if it says 26 feet,
you would think.
Missed that. And it should be 26.
I think we need to look at that then if we're going to make any recommendations or approval that that needs to be 26 feet, not 24.
Okay.
I don't know what the rationale is, but that's what the regulations say.
Yeah, and that's what we require to follow, so.
Fire apparatus access road shall not exceed 10% in grade. I doubt that's a problem.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
No. The minimum turning radius shall be determined by the fire code official. Who did you speak with?
I forget
his name. It's Ames. It's the Ames Fire Chief. I'm blanking on his name right now.
With the Delbert Franklin Township Fire Chief, because that's not an Ames area.
Yeah, but they are, you know, they get the final review, and the Ames Fire Chief has a copy of this. I have not heard back from him yet.
But the Gilbert?
Gilbert has a copy of the plan.
I heard back from
again, but
yeah.
We're required to do what Ames says in the situation.
But out of courtesy, and since Gilbert will be serving it, too. They've been notified, and they've got a copy of the plans.
Yep.
Ben Smith over there has it. So.
Yeah, I mean Ben. But Ames will not provide fire service to that area until
it happens.
Yeah.
Okay.
The fire apparatus is based off typically size of trucks, length of hose, and everything. And so the radius that they're actually meant for the City of Ames fire trucks, which are much bigger than the City of Gilbert fire trucks. So.
Length one more time.
The length of our
private
letter.
Yeah.
So what's your question?
Just how long they are?
The north one.
582.
Yeah.
Sorry, and then 415 for the south.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that.
That's the full length.
That's the full length. That's not the length to the actual turnaround, the stub out where the vehicle would move in and make its movement. Trying to find where that is.
So you looked at this table, and the second row applies to one, and the third row applies to the other one, then, in terms of the size of the hammerhead turnarounds. You checked all those, but those are correct. I'm just asking because you didn't have road
correct hydrant. So what are you looking at here?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, see that's basically the same for the two. For 500 to 750 feet, these all apply.
Okay.
I don't know why they separated them out because they're exactly the same. So.
Okay.
Yeah, on our northern drive, it's 414 feet to that turn stub and then another 168 feet to the end of it where the driveway of that last unit starts. On the south end, it's 289 to the turn stub and then another 126 feet to the end for a total of 415.
Other questions? Thank you.
Okay. And can I ask something? We received something from the Union Pacific Railroad this afternoon. You want me to read it? It's a two-page, or just identify the things that I've highlighted as what their points are. However you want me to do it. We received it at 2:30 today.
Can you summarize it for us?
I'll try.
Major points.
Yep. It says the proposed project location is near the UP's Jewel substation, which is an at-grade crossing. Any land planning decision should consider that train volumes near a project area may increase the future, or may increase in the future. We ask that the county and the project developers keep in mind that this is a vital and growing rail corridor, and nearby land uses should be compatible with this continuing rail use. And then it says appropriate modifications to the street and warning devices on any nearby rail crossings may need to be included as part of the project. Should the project be approved, UP suggests the county consider holding railroad and crossing safety presentations such as operator lifesaver for the public on an appropriate basis. It goes on and talks about increased traffic impact. An increase in traffic from the project may render inadequate the current safety devices in place on nearby at-grade crossings. Additionally, an increase of pedestrian and vehicular traffic may conflict with train operations, causing trains to proceed more slowly through the county and or make more frequent emergency stops, which may make rail service less efficient and effective. They're also concerned about the potential for more people trespassing through their right-of-way. And then they're also raising a comment about noise and vibration, that it is a 24-hour rail service, and that the applicant, the developer, should make sure that they communicate with proposed buyers that that there is potential for noise and vibration concerns. And again, it's a two-page,
okay,
written by Anna C. Palmer, paralegal, Union Pacific Railroad.
So we'll enter that into the record and file on the project in case anyone wants to read the whole thing. Essentially, just because it's not a busy line now doesn't mean it won't be in the future. All right. Would any members of the public like to comment on this proposal? Do you have any other submittals, letters, emails, phone calls?
We have not. We sent out notices two times, prior to each meeting, and did not. This is the only thing that we received, that we had correspondence from the MP.
Thank you, Commission. What are your feelings?
Can I ask Jerry a question? Jerry, based on the letter from the railroad, do you, from your department, feel that your expertise from the department, feel that we need to consider that in the original, in this process?
I'm not sure exactly. Well, I mean, we received this at 2:30. I think it's just part of this is just they want the county and the developers to communicate that there is a rail line there, which isn't too far-fetched. I mean, the rail line is a pretty decent distance away from where they're proposing to develop. They're proposing to develop on the west end. So, I mean, with some of these comments, to be honest with you, I'm not sure what these Operation Lifesavers training is. We can certainly inquire about what that is and what that means. I don't think the applicants would have a hard time with addressing some of the comments that are in this letter. You know, just to make sure that buyers are aware that if there's an active rail line, and it sounds like it's used 24/7. And you made a comment about the, I don't know how many frequent trips it takes, or maybe the representative from the golf course could respond to that, but...
I can say that... Could you step up and give us your name?
Corey Strait with Ames Golf and Country Club. I can say it's hard. I'm there a lot, but I'm not 24/7. But I would say it's not what I would call an extremely busy railroad. What I will say is just past our property, it goes through very tight residential spaces throughout Ames, and I can say that I have golfers. It goes right along the golf course, and I've never had a complaint from a golfer saying that the railroad disrupts their game.
Thanks. My interpretation of the letter, this is only mine, so don't put words in your mouth, but it's fairly standard. Better than that noble proposed near line, and this could be a low volume line for a long, long time, and then it could increase like that. So,
may I add personal reflection on this?
Yes.
I live probably as close to that railroad as most of these people would who live by these lots, and there's a few trains a day. They're very long, but you know, the only thing I would think, I mean, it's not an instance. The only thing I would think is the crossing does not have a gate that comes down. And I don't know. There's going to be more traffic along 190th when Grant Breton, whatever it's called where, gets paved to the high school. You know, and that's something somebody really should think about, particularly with all younger drivers that are going to be on that road then. Is maybe, a gate on that gate would make whatever.
Which has nothing to do with this proposal.
Which has nothing to do with this proposal, but that's the only thing I would see would be valid there. And I don't know, I suppose that, I don't know who decides that, but it's all going on in that area. There's so much development that that's something that the county might want to think about.
Mr. Gable.
I would like to move to approve this application with using the staff number 2 recommendation.
Good motion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
We have a motion by Gable, second by Miller. Could we have a roll call vote, please?
Steele?
No.
Merkin?
No.
Miller?
Yes.
Cable?
Yes.
Holstrom?
No.
I believe that the motion fails.
Okay.
Two ayes, three ayes.
I understand. I think it's extremely appropriate that those that said no voice their reasons for the no. They have an open meeting.
Sure. I can appreciate that. I think that the commission members are welcome to share whatever they like about their justification for the vote. I think that the members are also completely free to make a different motion at any time. I will say I'm willing to say, well, my problem with it is I've already asked the applicant about these issues,
It's primarily about the sheer volume of alternative compliance required, and that a vast majority of the plat doesn't meet the street standards in virtually any way.
Okay. Our chair made some compelling arguments about the stacking, as he called it, and I agree.
I will also echo to other individuals and concerning that it kind of seems like they continue to ask for special exception.
May I ask Jerry a question?
Sure.
Jerry, can you come up with a remedy for reducing the stacking?
It seems like most of the issues were with the drives. And if those were to be, there would have to be a public road, because if it's private, they can only have four lots. And so if they can only do four lots, they're probably not going to do the development. So I guess that would probably be the biggest thing. And I don't know that that's an option with what they're proposing with the space that they have to make that a public road like that south cul-de-sac.
Can I ask?
That'd be a good question for them. I don't know if they could do the development for, you know, I don't know if there's enough space there to do that, to have like a right-of-way area.
Can I ask, so 190th, would that be considered still a private road until it went all the way through, or is it just the primarily the road going into the development?
Yeah, 190th is a county road.
Okay.
That will continue to
so
be
that
county.
That's not the issue. Because looks like in the code on 707, it has something called a dead-end street, which includes cul-de-sacs, and in that situation, you can have up to 20 lots on the development, and it looks like that's what's going on there, but
I think the feasibility issue is just the redesign would have to happen to make space for a cul-de-sac and to create a public street that meets the franchise standards.
Because the private drives, they don't have right-of-way. It's just the road, and then you have the lots, and then the land around it would be the common space that would be used by everyone.
It's a tough site without the multiple jurisdictions involved. That's why the developers have been working on this for years and years.
Well, I can tell you too, staff, we spent time with the county attorney's office trying to, you know, look at this and, you know, is this something that they can request alternative compliance for? And the five things that they requested, the answer was that it was. So that's why it was brought forward to you for your review.
And then it's, you know, the code also clearly states that the burden of persuasion is on the applicant to show that they've provided a better, more innovative solution than what the code would allow. I mean, the intent is for the code to overcome weaknesses in the code to get a better development, not to bypass a requirement that's more expensive. Or that would require the sacrifice of a lot to accomplish. Commission meeting, take some action.
Trying to craft a motion, I've been trying to solve the developer's problem.
What's wrong with that?
I know, but I'm not.
Well, we're not designers.
We're not designers. My concern is really about that area, particularly that area to the north of, immediately north of Country Club. It just seems jammed in, it seems like it's creating problems.
One thing I'd point out is that regardless of the action we take tonight, this does advance to the Board of Supervisors.
Yes.
It doesn't begin or end here.
Recommendation.
It's a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors.
Right. At first, though, we'll go to the City Council, City of Ames, and then, of course, the Rams.
Do we have a motion?
Can you put your options up there, Jerry? Story County Planning and Zoning Commission recommends denial of the major subdivision preliminary plat of the Irons as put forth in case SUB-02-16 to the Story County Board of Supervisors and direct staff to place this item on the Board of Supervisors' agenda. My motion.
Motion. Is there a second? Merkin, a second by Miller. Roll call vote, please.
Cable?
No.
Merkin?
Yes.
Steele?
Yes.
Holstrom?
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Okay. The motion is successful, and Jerry will put this on the Board of Supervisors' agenda at an appropriate time, as fits in the fringe area process.
Just a point of clarification. Jerry, does this go back to Ames before it goes,
to the City Council first and then the Board of Supervisors?
Okay.
You said the City Council
approved it? We're going to take a short recess and re-adjourn at 10 minutes to 7.
So they already acted on
it. All right, let's call the meeting back to order, please. The next item on the agenda is CUP 0316. Jerry? No.
Emily.
Emily.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah. I'll try it out. This
is a little closer, man. It's a
This application is for a conditional use permit, CUP 316. The applicant is Dean and Denise Beekler. They reside on 160th Street, northeast of Ames. Their proposal is for a bed and breakfast on the property that they recently purchased. And that is right across the street from where they currently are living. The application is for a conditional use permit that proposes a bed and breakfast and event venue. The bed and breakfast would be available for 12 months out of the year for 8 adults, but up to 14 guests if there are children. The target audience are, for this bed and breakfast are those that are interested in the county the country setting and recreational users. The event venue would be available between April and October, and eventually could get to be to serve about 150 to up to 350 guests. This would be for small weddings, catered parties, receptions, meetings, conferences, those sorts of things. So here's just a map of the vicinity. You see we're northeast of Ames in northwestern Milford Township, right on the edge there. We're right along the Skunk River. kind of sandwiched between I-35 and Highway 69 there. The road to the north of the property is 160th Street. The property itself is primarily zoned A1. There is a portion of the property that is zoned Greenbelt Conservation, but there's no proposed development within that area. So to the east of the property is the Greenbelt Conservation District, and to the west is the A1 District. The property itself is 11.29 acres, and it's zoned A1 once again. The dwelling itself was built in 1957, and the parcel was split from the farmland in 1982. The septic system was replaced in less than a year ago, in 2015. The property itself is 3,729 square feet. The driveway to the property, to the dwelling itself, is about a quarter mile long. The property has geothermal heating and is served by Midland Power Co-op. So the project itself, the applicant is proposing a four-room bed and breakfast. Dean and Denise Beekler, the applicants, will reside in the ground floor apartment and manage the bed and breakfast. They may need to, in terms of employees, they may need to hire, depending on how the bed and breakfast takes off, they may need to hire a housekeeper or a gardener, but we did note that their employees will need to meet the requirements set forth by the county's code. Breakfast will be made by the applicants, and much of the food will be sourced from the family's existing garden on the property directly to the north of the proposed bed and breakfast. In terms of the event venue, the applicant would like to begin with smaller events, 20 to 40 people, with the intention of building on those in future years. The planned improvements would include converting the front two-car garage to reception and conference venue. And to this, they would add on about a 900-square-foot outdoor pavilion and a restroom inside. The possible, looking forward, another one of the possibilities would be to renovate the 1944 barn that is directly south of the dwelling to provide for an even larger reception area. So here's a site map. I zoomed in a little bit here. This is the north end of the property. The dwelling itself is right here in the center. The proposed four-season venue, which they would convert the current two-car garage into a proposed four-season venue, and the three-season, the pavilion-type structure, would just be directly off the two-car garage. Once again, the pavilion would be about 900 square feet, so not a huge structure. The existing well to the south, the septic tank is to the north of the property there. The septic field right here. They have the kind of some outdoor spaces outlined on the map for us here. There we go. To the south of the dwelling, which is right here, once again, they have the barn that was built in 1944 that they would, in the future, be interested in renovating for a larger venue space. There is a horse barn behind the barn there. The applicants are very interested in conservation and outdoor recreation, including hiking and birding. And so they want to be able to offer their guests a place to even keep their horses so they could horseback ride on the trails, just as another option. Okay, so looking at the six items that we use to determine conditional uses, compatibility, this is an economic opportunity for the agricultural community, and it is